For the week of February 18th, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 400, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birnenzana, I'm Michael Giltz.
Okay, what is Birnenzana? That to me sounds like, I don't know, an ale or an IPA or something.
It's the capital of Wakanda.
Oh, okay. You know what? I'm seeing Black Panther later this week in the 4XD format. So I
haven't seen it yet.
I have not seen it yet. No.
Oh, I didn't know you were racist.
No, I'm seeing it in the Screen X format, actually.
Oh, okay. I didn't know you were racist.
No, I'm not. I knew I was seeing it in a special format. I wanted it to be the first time I saw the movie.
well, cool. Well, Happy New Year. We're in the midst of Chinese New Year and the Spring Festival, so that's going to have a big impact on the box office. A lot of people in China are busy going to the movies. That's clearly the case in North America. I guess people love President's Day, but we got a lot to talk about, not just Wakanda. Tell us what it's going to be.
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we will discuss, of course, Black Panther. Will the latest big budget film with black stars to score a box office hit finally change the culture of Hollywood? The movie is number one. The soundtrack is number one. Heck, even the Russians are talking about it. We know because, you know, we now have the proof, actually. Oscar voters are surely talking about the BAFTA awards. Those were handed out Sunday, and they seem to reinforce what everyone is saying. The actors categories look to be locked in stone, but Best Picture is still up for grabs. Oh, and MoviePass? Yeah, it's still making news, you know, again, for all the wrong reasons. Also, again, during Book Filter, Michael will have to choose between the story of a closeted father and daughter or the true life spy thriller about the biggest secret of the Cold War. That always seems to be, you know, when it comes to like the biggest secret of World War II, it's always the biggest. There's never like, you know, it never ends. Anyway.
Well, the second biggest of World War II just doesn't sell tickets.
That's true. In sexual misconduct, we see the Me Too movement headed to the world of publishing, specifically young adult authors. On Inside Baseball, we are sorry to say that Barnes & Noble seems to be going down for the count. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines, and we'll be joined by our former co-host and social media consultant, Karen Woodward. But woo-hoo! First, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also link to Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, you name it. And the number one movie around the world. And get this, this is on a weekend when China is opening up four or five huge, big budget movies that made a massive amount of money. Any other weekend, they would have probably been the number one movie in the world. But no, it's Black Panther. And new numbers just came in while we were recording the show. Another $35 million has been added to the box office. It looks like the worldwide gross on opening weekend for Black Panther is $404 million. That includes, of course, Thursday night, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and we're adding in numbers from Monday as well because it's a holiday weekend here in North America. $404 million.
So it's basically, its production budget has broken even. So now we're into marketing. It's
right,
chewing away
right.
Marketing.
It doubled its budget of $200 million. There's a lot more to say about Black Panther. Let's go through the rest of the list and then come back to that because we could talk about it, frankly, for an hour. It's fascinating on a lot of different levels. But the number two movie around the world is from China. It's the Spring Festival season. People travel home for the New Year's to be with their families. It's a huge annual migration. So everybody then goes to the movies. The number two movie around the world is Monster Hunt 2, a family-friendly fantasy flick about the distant past when humans and monsters live together. I don't know the budget of this movie, but the first one cost $56 million. This movie, Monster Hunt 2, was the big winner, though there were a lot of winners in China this weekend. $190 million is what it has grossed so far.
And that should give you some sense, by the way. That number, $190 million, in any other week, like last weekend, when, you know, Fifty Shades Freed opened last weekend, that would have blown away worldwide competition.
Absolutely. It would have been a big, big hit. They plan to make four movies in all, so they plan to do two more live-action films and then an animated spinoff of Monster Hunt. So that's a franchise. Hollywood isn't the only one that does that. And number three right below that is Detective Chinatown 2. That made $155 million, another big success. It's about goofy young cops, and the first movie, those Chinese guys headed to Bangkok. In this movie, they headed to New York City. The first had a budget of $15 million, so even if that doubled or tripled, they're doing great. Another hit, Monkey King 3. Monkey King, of course, is the classic fable that every Chinese person know, every person in Asia, and even a lot of Caucasians now know about it. This is the third in a particular series about the Monkey King. It made $80 million on its opening weekend. Then there's the sort of patriotic flag-waving movie Operation Red Sea, which is a sequel of sorts to another movie called Operation. This one is about the rescue of Chinese people from Yemen during the 2015 Civil War, and it grossed $70 million on its opening weekend. And skipping down below that, we have Boonie Bears, The Big Shrink. That's a low-budget family fare. It's an animated movie, sort of like Yogi Bear, bears in the woods and environmental. It grossed $40 million over this opening holiday season mark. So those are five big movies. There are a couple more Chinese films that opened up a week ago. They're way overshadowed by these. So a big successful launch to the Chinese New Year. And one interesting facet is that the government is also cracking down on ticket subsidies.
Oh, yeah. That's been for a while now.
That is. But they've imposed some new rules. They said, all right, here's some new rules about ticket subsidies. First of all, there has to be a minimum ticket price. Right now, they set that at 19.9 yuan. That's equivalent, under today's trading, you know, amount, to $3.15. So you can't sell a ticket for less than $3.15. They also said you can only subsidize 500,000 tickets per movie. So if you want to give away low budget tickets, okay, but it has to cost at least $3.15. And you can only give away 500,000 tickets, which means you want to get word of mouth, you want to get families going, you want people to get excited about the movie, fine, but the total gross of that movie is only going to be about 1.5 million in subsidized ticket sales. So at this stage, when you're talking about big budget movies and they're grossing 70 million, 80 million, 150 million, 190 million, that $1.5 million of subsidized tickets, it's really negligible. I don't even know why they bother anymore.
Now, I just want to kind of point something out here. Last weekend, okay, 3-day weekend, the box office in the United States for the top 56 movies was $284.7 million, okay? Now, if you add up Monster Hunt 2, $90 million? Detective Chinatown, $155 million. You're already...
$490 if you add up the next two. So $490 million with Monkey King 3 and Operation Red Sea. And that's then Boonie Bears, that's $530 million.
Think about that. That's a lot of money for a single territory.
Well, and flip that. That's sort of their equivalent of our Christmas holiday season or Thanksgiving or July 4th, whereas we're talking about February. It's just President's Day. Remember, Hollywood didn't even release movies until May. You know, January would just be the expansion of the Oscar season. There'd be nothing coming out in February or March or April except the Oscar holdovers that had platformed out and were ready for a wide release. You had to wait until May, really the end of May, to get a big movie. But that has changed now. Hollywood is releasing big movies every month of the year, practically every week of the year. So that's the flip side. You know, we're competing every single day of the year. This isn't our Christmas or New Year or July 4th. This is just a regular weekend in February, and they released a big budget movie, and it paid off big time. But let's finish with the box office. Right below Operation Red Sea is 50 Shades Freed, another $65 million on the weekend. That's at $270 million worldwide. Then the Chinese animated film Boonie Bears. And below that, another sort of live-action animation combo. It's Peter Rabbit, which cost $50 million to make, and it's just about hit $50 million worldwide. And they've also had to give out an apology.
Yeah, I guess, and I saw the movie over the weekend, and I guess there was one moment in the film where Peter and, Flopsy Mopsy Cottontail, they're trying to break into the neighbor's garden, and the neighbor is allergic to blackberries. They happen to know this, so they slingshot a blackberry into his mouth, and the character goes into anaphylactic shock.
Hilarious, unless, of course, he died.
Yeah, well, he didn't. And that, you know, when he comes back to life, they're like, he's superhuman, you know. But, you know, I guess Kenneth.
Well, the studio realized, oh, actually, not a good joke, because kids will watch that and go, ha ha, Billy has a peanut butter allergy. Let's give him peanut butter. Hilarious.
Right. And so there was they had to issue an apology. They think now, well, maybe that wasn't such a good idea.
Right. So a mistake. And I think future movies, importantly, will realize, that's not a good thing to do. At number nine, right below Peter Rabbit, is The Greatest Showman, still chugging along. $14 million on the weekend, $340 million worldwide. To be specific, $340 million, 78,356. That would have been 346, but I saw The Greatest Showman over the weekend.
And?
This is me. You know, it's like a Western. I was just glad to see a musical. Certainly, there are a lot of problems with it, but I was just happy to see a musical, so I didn't mind it. It's not great by any stretch of the imagination. Every song is sort of annoyingly empowering, but, you know, I've seen worse in my lifetime. It's not a good, I'd give it 2 stars out of 4, but again, you know, the new sheriff rides into town, I'm happy. People start to sing and dance in a musical, I'm sold. At number 10 is The Shape of Water. That's at $91 million worldwide. A number 11 is Maze Runner, The Death Cure. That's the movie that beat Star Wars in China. That grossed $13 million on the weekend. It's at $260 million worldwide. All good news for everybody except the author James Dashner, who will be appearing in our sexual misconduct section. At number 12 is Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, starring Dwayne Johnson, another person of color starring in a big blockbuster movie. $12 million on the weekend, $904 million worldwide. I assume it won't get to $1 billion, but you know what? If they left it in the theater, it just might do it.
I'd go see it if they left it in the theater.
Well, it's still there right now. At number 13 is The 1517 to Paris, the Clint Eastwood thriller, $10 million on the weekend, $36 million worldwide. And number 14 is a movie I didn't know what country it was from, really, until the last possible second. Just now I found out because Chinese Media Daily told me that there'd been a deal to bring this film to China. They're going to bring it to those screens. It's a Russian ice skating movie called Ice. $8.7 million on the weekend. It just opened up in Russia, obviously timed to the Winter Olympics. So good tie in there. It's going to go into China probably sooner rather than later. We'll have to see if it makes it to North America.
Well, wait a second. Time to the Winter Olympics that Russia can't compete in? Technically,
well, Russian athletes are competing in, but you know, if you made a movie about ice skating, sure, absolutely. They're watching it on TV. People are all talking about ice skating for 2 weeks every 2 years or 4 years, which is what they do. I actually watch a little bit like ice skating all the time, but you know, it's good timing. It makes sense. And number 15 is Coco. That's at $730 million worldwide for the Pixar animated film. And then below that is two more Chinese films. One is the Hong Kong comedy, The Faces of My Gene. That made $7.8 million on the weekend, clearly overshadowed by the big guns. And below that, the second weekend for Detective K, Secret of the Living Dead. That's the period comedy mystery where Detective K is tracking down a vampire. $7 million on the weekend. That's at $14 million worldwide. One movie or two movies were brave enough to open up against Black Panther here in North America, and that movie was Early Man. There was a Christian faith-based film that opened very modestly at like $2 million on the weekend. And then there was Early Man, the Nick Park stop-motion animation movie. That grossed $6.8 million on the weekend worldwide. That's at $21 million. So it looks like it's going to be one of the less successful Nick Park movies because most of them have made their money back and been pretty successful worldwide. This may be, it's got a long ways to go. It's only in 12 territories, but it's not setting the world on fire where it should, which is the UK and North America. And at number 19 is Golden Slumber. This is a Korean action thriller, and it stars Gang Dong-won. And it's about a prime minister being assassinated. And our hero, played by Gang, is an innocent delivery man who is framed as the killer, and he must go on the run, a la The Fugitive. It opened to $6.8 million, and I don't know what the movie cost. But Gang is sort of an interesting case. He's a rising star. He's been successful for quite a few years, and he's really been judicious in choosing his movies. Sometimes in Korea and some of these other countries like India, and you'll see people make 3-4 movies a year. He's been very slow and methodical, making big movies and small movies, but not making a ton of them. So this year looked like it was going to be his big year. He filmed 3 movies that are set to come out in 2018. Unfortunately, in 2017, stories about his grandfather came out being a collaborator with the Japanese during World War II, including with Comfort Women, which is not Gang's fault, obviously. And he apologized and has kept a low profile all year long. But whether that has impacted his box office long term, I don't know. But it's certainly something to keep an eye on. And scrolling down, 3 Billboards is at $111 million worldwide. The Post, which I finally saw, the Spielberg film, that's at $130 million worldwide. The French goofy broad comedy, Le Touche 3, that's at $38 million worldwide. Darkest Hour, Gary Oldman's Oscar hopeful, which did well at the BAFTAs. That's at $130 million worldwide. And here's another new movie, the last one we have. It's A Casa Tutti Bene, an Italian family melodrama. I watched the trailer. There were no English subtitles, but it's a big family. They're laughing. They're joking. They're happy. And then a secret is revealed. And suddenly everybody starts yelling at each other. And it's melodramatic. It's very, very Italian. I kind of want to see it just based on the trailer. That opened to $4 million.
You know, watching curling, okay, over the week, the past week at the Olympics, watching the Italian men versus the U.S. men in curling, watching them, the Italian men yell at one another about, you know, sweep, sweep, you know, a little more to the left, a little more to the right. It was just so funny because everything sounded like they were ordering at an Italian restaurant.
Yes, it's fun. It's one of the few sports where you get to yell at your teammate.
Yeah, exactly.
You get to drink before and after, and you yell at your teammate. Or if you're a Russian, you dope. There's a doping scandal with one of the Russian curlers, which, to be fair, the other competitors say, I don't know. That doesn't seem right because there's really no reason to dope in curling. So
no.
They're like, I mean, I guess, you know, people are starting to work out now in curling and try to stay more fit because it can be taxing on your back and stuff. But they're like, yeah, you know, we drink afterwards. I just can't imagine he would dope. So they all want to wait and see. And maybe it was a false positive or something like that. But we'll have to see. But it brings us back to Black Panther, which you haven't seen. But, you know, it set every box office, you know, one box office record after another. A huge, huge hit.
Yes, and this was a huge hit going into the weekend. The question was just how big a hit will it be? Because that, you know, most analysts said, okay, it's going to make $160 million. That was at the beginning of last week, and then toward the middle of last week, they went, or maybe 170, and then by Thursday, they were like, or maybe 190. You know, so it just kept going up and up and up, and in large part, that's because entire theaters were bought out by groups going to see this movie.
Well, black audiences obviously turned out. They usually make about 15% of a superhero movie. They were 35% of the audience for Black Panther, so they showed up. They are very loyal audiences. Black people tend to show up on opening weekend big time. They want to be there right away to see movies that are geared towards them, that feature stars that they love, and they're very active moviegoers, and you make a movie that appeals to them, they will show up on opening weekend. So let's not freak out if it drops by 75% next weekend. You know, everybody saw this movie. People saw it twice. It's gotten great reviews. It's gotten great audience scores. It may have tremendous legs. If it drops by 60%, that will be a huge hold. Obviously, any hold will be huge when you make $235 million in North America. So again, you know, relax. If it drops by 70% next weekend, so what? That means it's making like what, $80 million or something?
Everybody in the industry that tracks box office expects a 60% drop next week, especially because this is a holiday weekend here in the United States. So there is a definite drop off next weekend, which is to be expected.
And the biggest news is how well it's done worldwide. It did great in South Korea. It's going to be playing in China, but it's not opening right now, of course, because they have all their big movies coming out during the spring season. Trailers internationally and posters sort of downplayed the black characters. They had Black Panther in his full outfit. And the trailers focused on the action to try and de-emphasize the Afrocentric nature of the movie. Obviously, they couldn't wholly de-emphasize it, but they're trying to play up the action and the guy in the costume to try and sell it worldwide. And it's working. You know, it's a $200 million budget movie. You haven't seen it. I have to tell you, number one, I don't know how it costs $200 million because it doesn't seem like that big of a movie. There's only like one or two big set pieces. I don't know why this costs $200 million. But I'm sure it did, or like that's the number they wanted out there to say, hey, we spent our money on this movie. Don't think we're, you know, doing a low budget Black Panther. They wouldn't want that out. But I'm telling you, if I had that script in front of me and I would not have had the guts to greenlight this at $200 million. No way. Because this movie is so Afrocentric. This is like a superhero movie conceived by Sun Ra, the jazz musician. I mean, it is out there. It is like no holds barred, Afrocentric, baby. We got one white token character. He can go away. I mean, it is hardcore Afrocentric. And I would have said, like, can we do it for $125 million? And I still would have felt like that was a big roll of the dice. So that was a gutsy, gutsy move to greenlight this movie at $200 million. I mean, all credit to the people at Disney who did that.
Well, a couple of things. One, what I saw at Expo Cine, I saw about 20, 25 minutes of the film. And I'd agree with you. You know, it definitely didn't look like $200 million. So I wonder, Disney, Marvel, they knew this was a hit, okay? They know this is a hit movie. It's going to make its money back. And usually when you know it's not a hit, all of a sudden you can't find the budget, or the budget gets lowered to $25 million, even though you look at it and go, yeah, that's not $25 million. That's $125 million on screen.
Well, they knew it was a hit a few weeks out, and the tracking was always obviously great, and it just built and built and built. But boy, I've said before, they're leaving money on the table by not putting the Madea movies out. They're leaving money on the table by not promoting a lot of films with black stars worldwide. I think there's money to be made. So I think they were right to make the movie, and it wasn't a guaranteed slam dunk worldwide, but by God, they're going to do it. So all credit to them. But we've got a long list, of course, of stars worldwide who have done well over the years. You know, Eddie Murphy, Will Smith, and maybe Vin Diesel and Dwayne Johnson don't track as white or people of color to Hollywood. They're like, oh, well, they're not black people. They're just, you know, cool. But they are, and they are starring in big hit films. They're not this, Afrocentric the way Black Panther is, but they are stars playing movies all over the world that people flock to see. So there's every reason to think that, this movie can work too. So, you know, I think you got to throw out the window any idea, you know, this is not 12 Years a Slave or some noble drama where, you know, white people can see it and learn history and feel bad. This is just a film made specifically for an audience. And like Superfly and Shaft in the 70s, you feel like it wasn't made for you if you're not a person of color. And that's really cool. And you're like, wow, that whole action film thing has a new vibe when it's presented by somebody with a new perspective on it, and it feels fresh to everybody. And that's certainly what happened here.
Well, my point in mentioning the budget is I almost wonder if they're throwing the marketing budget in there too, just as a way to talk up the budget.
Push it up. Yeah. They don't want to say we did it on the cheap, for sure.
Exactly. But, in other words, no. We treat all of our superhero movies the same. They all get $200 million budgets. It doesn't matter whether we think we're taking a risk with an Afrocentric film or a risk with a film like Wonder Woman that might be, you know, we think might skew just to women. Nope, we spend $200 million on all of them, especially when we know they're hits. If we think they're going to tank, we only spend $25 million.
I'll tell you, this movie is as if Wonder Woman began on the island of Lesbos and never left. I mean, there's like, we don't need men. We don't need the World War II. We just want women in Amazonian costumes fighting and arguing with each other. I mean, it's literally so focused on what matters to them. It's awesome. It really is culturally fascinating what they did with this movie. And it's also a James Bond film, which I don't think comes across in the trailers, but it's literally like our first black James Bond. I mean, he has a scene where he meets with Q, basically his sister, who shows him the new tech toys that she has.
Yeah.
He has the fast cars. He has a scene in a casino, just like James Bond. There's the car chase scenes. It's just a James Bond film in every possible way, except that it's not officially a James Bond film, and it's set in Wakanda. So that was an interesting element I didn't expect. I do wish it was a better movie. I didn't think it was a good movie. I thought it was poorly directed in terms of the action. I thought it was very underwhelming in the finale and the big action set piece in the casino. But I thought Chadwick Boseman was kind of a bore. Frankly, he was a stiff. Maybe that's Black Panther's thing. Maybe T'Challa is always a bit dull. The villain is often more colorful than the hero. But, you know, Michael B. Jordan blew the screen away off Chadwick Boseman. You couldn't help wishing he'd been cast as Black Panther. So, I didn't see The Last Avengers, but apparently he had a cool stunt or a big action set piece in that movie. I have to go back and see that because I didn't really feel it paid off action-wise here, but it is certainly a cultural event.
Well, when you went to see Black Panther this week, I know you're a MoviePass subscriber now, and you use it quite a bit. Did you use it to go see Black Panther?
I haven't used it quite a bit yet. I keep thinking I'll use it more, but I certainly have been going to more movies, and I'm certainly getting my money's worth, and I absolutely did use it on Saturday night. I went to see Black Panther, and our friend Aaron Rich went to see 50 Shades Freed and found out he had been canceled and he was no longer a member. They had just shut down his account.
Yeah, now I would be interested to know why, and he should definitely contact MoviePass. I mean, here's what goes on. All subscription services like this have fraud detection, you know, and fraud prevention. They're a little late in terms of they ramped up so quickly, MoviePass that is, to 2 million users, that even if you had, let's say, a half of 1% committing fraud on MoviePass, okay, that's just a half of 1%. So minuscule, right? Compared to 2 million users, you'd have 10,000 people committing fraud, okay? And when your margins are as slim as they are with MoviePass, meaning they don't have any.
No, they lose money on every sale.
Yeah, that they have to actually be very careful about that. So when they're looking at people who might be trying to buy a 3D ticket at a movie theater and trying to, you know, hoodwink the box office there, or they might buy a gift card or return their ticket to get cash, even though, you know, they bought it with MoviePass, or they buy a ticket and then turn around and resell it because, you know, they're not going to go see the movie and then they get cash that way. They actually, you know, MoviePass went out and they found this was happening, and they targeted specific accounts where this was happening. And what
you're taking their line, and I think it's total BS.
Really?
I'm sorry. Two weeks ago, they deleted some of the most popular movie theater locations in the country from their approved list. Then they tried to pass it off as a marketing ploy when people said, hey, what's going on here? They said, oh, we're just showing AMC how powerful we are. To which you rightly said, well, why did they keep it a secret beforehand? You would announce it and say, this is what we're doing. But in fact, they only tried to justify it after the fact.
And they admitted, they did admit in an interview, Mitch Lowe said, I should, you know, in hindsight, we should have announced it beforehand. I would handle that differently now.
Right, but we don't believe them. You also say, yeah, they just happened to shut down the most popular ones in the country where they're losing the most money. Oh, what a coincidence. And the second thing is, now they've deleted accounts of users. They're claiming they defrauded them. But guess what? All these people are saying, what are you talking about? I didn't do this. They're claiming that ushers and people in movie theaters are calling them up and saying, MoviePass, this guy is just trying to defraud you. A, you can't reach them on the phone. There's no number to call. Unless they've handed out a secret phone number to movie theaters, their customer service is non-existent. If you want to try and contact MoviePass because you have a problem, it doesn't work. People for months now have been saying, hey, I've got these tickets up saying I tried to buy this ticket and it wouldn't work and the thing jammed, and you email them and then you're given a ticket number. No one ever contacts you. They have the worst customer service in the world. So the idea that ushers are calling them.
Not to take their side, they have actually admitted that
the idea that the theaters are reaching them is absurd. And if the theaters, we're talking about presumably these few small chains that actually care because they have a piece of MoviePass, why would they call them up and go, this guy's trying to defraud you? They would just say, I'm sorry, sir, you can't use your MoviePass to buy concessions. That's not hard to do. If they're actually in the game and care, unlike AMC, they would just say, oh, no, I'm sorry, that's only good for purchasing a ticket. You know, you can't buy a gift card, you can't buy concessions. That's not hard to do. And if they have a piece of the company, all they would do is say, no, thank you. I'm sorry, we can't accept that for concessions. That's only good for buying a ticket. To which the person would shamefacedly go, oh, you're right. I'm sure somebody has tried to do everything they describe. But when you see hundreds of people going online or swarming Twitter and going, what the heck's going on? And when they say, well, you did this or that, they're like, no, I didn't. Aaron is like, I didn't do any of that.
Now, Aaron Rich is has been a guest on the show where he's
he's our in-house movie critic. He's a film scholar, and he's heading to Austin to look at some papers held in that archive involving film production history. And he uses his movie pass a fair amount, but he has never tried to defraud them in any way, shape, or form. And he's tried to reach them, and no luck so far. So hopefully he'll reach them this week. We'll find out what he has and get him on the show. But I think they went overboard. I'm sure they found some examples of fraud, but they have using some algorithm or some way where they think this is suspicious activity, and they just shut people down. And the worst thing is people just showed up at the theater. That's how they found out. Suddenly the thing didn't work.
Or they got an email.
No, that was after he went to the theater and found out he was shut down. He wouldn't have gone to the theater to see 50 Shades Freed if he'd been told his car didn't work. You know?
Right.
So I think, again, they are screwing up. They are crappy customer service, crappy PR. They're trying to combat whatever minuscule fraud they had, but they've caught up a lot of fair use users. So now people think, well, God, why am I going to pay for the service? They're just going to shut it down if I try to go to too many movies. That's the message they're sending right now.
Yeah, certainly from a PR perspective, you are correct. I would say that that is what the vibe they're giving off from based on what they're saying. They probably are trying to do a little bit of fraud prevention. The problem
is, screwed up.
Are they doing it properly? Well, again, I can't answer that. Of course, whenever you do fraud prevention, you will have some false positives. By the way, that's the second time on this episode that you have heard the word false positive. I don't think you've heard it on any other episode. 400 episodes, we've never said false positive, except today we've used it twice.
Now, we'll use it three times. Are the BAFTAs a false positive when it comes to predicting the Oscars?
I don't think so. I think that you have the director, Shape of Water, Guillermo del Toro, won. I think he will probably win the Oscar for Best Director. Best Film was Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. This is the big question mark. Will it be Shape of Water? Will it be Three Billboards? Will it be Get Out? Get Out wasn't nominated for Best Film because it's not a British film.
And has, if Dunkirk can't win, and that to me seems a film that should appeal to the British highly, along with Darkest Hour. If Dunkirk, maybe those two movies split the Dunkirk vote or the Churchill vote.
Right.
But if Dunkirk can't win here, my hopes for it winning at Oscar time have certainly dimmed quite a bit.
Right. And Frances McDormand won Leading Actress for Three Billboards. Leading Actor was Gary Oldman for Darkest Hour, all as expected. Supporting Actress Allison Janney for I, Tonya. Again, somewhat expected. And supporting actor was Sam Rockwell for Three Billboards, also that's expected.
That's right. So the major awards were sort of lockstep with the front runners that we have right now, putting an asterisk by Best Picture, because that's sort of gone back and forth between Shape of Water and Three Billboards. There can always be an upset. I assume there will be an upset in one category, because otherwise it would be such a boring night. And you never know what the Oscars are going to do. But one reason to think the BAFTAs are mirroring the Oscars is because they now do their voting exactly like the Oscars. They're a similar group with a wide range of people. It's not like just actors or just directors. It's everyone in the British industry. And they let the guilds pick the nominations in each category, like the cinematographers pick the best DP. And then everybody votes on the winners. So it's done exactly the same way the Oscars are. And it's done by a similar body of people working in the industry. So it's sort of the closest mirror image to what the Oscars is. And, you know, since they switched to that, I think it was 2010 or 11 or 12, something like that, they've done a pretty darn good job of predicting the Oscars. We'll have to see come Oscar night. But it's interesting.
You know, what I find interesting is that there were no movie reboots or television sequels or spinoffs this week.
But there was in theater.
What?
The Sting, one of the big movies of all time, a really popular entertainment, and a Best Picture winner. Did that win Best Picture? No.
I don't know. Maybe it did, actually.
It's the 70s, so it's hard to remember because there were such, you know, we'll have to look that up.
I'll look it up while you keep going.
It is coming to Broadway. I mean, it's not. It's coming to Jersey. The Paper Mill Playhouse has been an excellent launch board for Broadway musicals. And out of the blue, suddenly they announced The Sting is coming to Paper Mill, starring Harry Connick Jr. His talk show was just canceled, so his schedule is wide open after he had two seasons of his daytime talk show. And now he's going to appear in a show. A lot of big talent involved in this. They haven't announced the full cast yet, but it starts like at the end of March, and I'm going to see it on April 8th. So this sucker is happening soon. It's a natural for turning into a musical because you've got that damn ragtime going all throughout the movie. He's a fun actor. He's going to play the Paul Newman character, and we'll have to see what happens, but I'm very excited by this.
And it did win Best Picture, and I'm just seeing now that it won Best Picture, and Tony Bill was one of the producers on that film. That's kind of remarkable. I did not know that. My Bodyguard was his first movie as a director. Remember Tony Bill?
Yeah.
Marvin Hamlish won for Best Music.
Which is because they confused him with Scott Joplin.
Right.
When he died, the Yankees did a tribute to Marvin Hamlisch, and they played Scott Joplin's song, The Entertainer. It was like, whoops, close.
Yeah. And Best Writing, and Best Director, and Best Costume Design. This was a Paul Newman, Robert Redford thing.
Oh, absolutely. You know, after Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, they followed up with this, one of the great teams. Did they do anything else after this? I don't think so. But those two movies were big, big movies. Oh, and now speaking of Oscars, there's finally a Variety story saying, okay, Black Panther's a phenomenon, but will it be an Oscar player?
Oh my God.
No, it won't be.
Seriously? How, like, come on. Wow.
And it won't be. No.
But what will be a player this week when I go to my local bookstore, which happens to be a Barnes & Noble, what will I be trying to purchase there? And that's actually my way of moving us into our book filter segment, where every week Michael dives into the new releases and brings us a book that's ready for its close-up. What have you got for us this week, Michael?
I just couldn't make up my mind. One book is a memoir. It's called Hiding Out by Tina Alexis Allen, who's an actress who's appeared on some TV shows and done other work. She was the youngest of 13 kids. Her dad was extremely religious, a very religious Catholic, to the point where he ran a travel agency arranging trips to the Holy Land, and he was even knighted by the Pope. He's Ooh. Like, sir, whatever. I mean, that's amazing. Problem was that Tina loved basketball and girls, and at 18, her dad discovered her secret, and then he told her, guess what? I'm gay too. And then they start going out to nightclubs together and doing drugs together. And they're picking up people and going off and having sex. I was like, oh my God, they're leading this huge double life. And their family has no idea. 12 other kids, his wife, no idea that these two are running off with this secret gay life. She joins the travel agency. She becomes the heir apparent. And then she starts to notice, wow, he goes on these business trips that don't make any sense. He's got briefcases full of cash. He has multiple passports. Her dad's double life actually has a triple life. It's just like this crazy, crazy story that I don't know if it would make a movie, but it's so nutty and out there. It just is fascinating. And she's like, I can play myself as an adult. I'm sure that's part of her thinking. But a more traditional pick would be In the Enemy's House. This is by Howard Bloom of Vanity Fair, which means it's probably already been optioned. It's the true life story from the Cold War that's dubbed the greatest secret of the Cold War. And it's where a U.S. codebreaker figures out that the Soviet Union has placed spies throughout our government to steal secrets, including the atomic bomb. And he works with an FBI agent together to try and ferret out the spies. It's this elaborate program that almost no one knows about. They're chalk and cheese. They're completely different guys. It's that classic Hollywood pairing of a buddy cop comedy. And they catch spy after spy, including the Rosenbergs, who passed on nuclear weapons information to the Russians. And now they realize the bigger secret is that someone is tipping the Russians off about what they're doing. And there's a high-placed mole that's bigger and badder than anybody else they ever thought of. It's like the British, you know, Guy Burgess scandal, where there's somebody so high up it would blow everyone's mind, and they're in a race against time to try and figure out who that person is before they're, you know, it's all blown up in their face. So it's a classic spy thriller, two guys, you know, chalk and cheese in terms of their approach to everything. So it sounds like a classic, easy Hollywood movie for them to do.
Well, The Enemy's House, or In the Enemy's House, sounds really interesting, and maybe I'll head on over to Barnes & Noble later today and pick that up if it's out, and maybe I'll even pick up The Maze Runner, because I haven't, there's a whole series I haven't read.
Hold on a second. That brings us to our sexual misconduct section.
Oh, okay, yeah. Every week we've been tracking ever since last October, the sexual misconduct stories that have been emerging out of the industry. We hope to be able to stop doing this sometime soon, sometime real soon. And what do we have this week?
Well, Jeffrey Tambor was officially fired from Transparent. The Universal Marketing Department for their movies is kind of in shambles after multiple people had to exit due to investigations of their sexual misconduct. That's really a serious problem for Universal. Here in New York City, nobody in the theater world can talk about anything except the fact that playwright Neil LaBute was dumped from his longtime residency at MCC Theater in New York City. He has done 10 plays over the last 15 years with that company. His plays are known for their boundary, button-pushing, sexual misconduct palooza-type topics. And so it's almost impossible to hear that they split up and no one will say why without thinking, it must be sexual misconduct. It's not fair to him. Just because he's writing about it doesn't mean that's what happened. But you literally, you can't get it out of your head until we find out what's going on. You just can't think about anything else other than, oh my God, what did he do? Not fair to Neil LaBute, but that's where we're at right now.
It also happens to help, at least help might be the wrong word, but I think the reason people jump to that automatically is given the topics that he writes about, misogyny,
yes,
et cetera.
Yes. Exactly, which I said, yes.
Right.
So that brings us to the bigger focus, which is sort of new in the publishing world. They're starting to grapple with it, just like in the music industry. And it's especially zeroed in on the young adult section. There was an article online, and then suddenly in the comments section, people started to come forward and say, this guy behaved inappropriately, that guy behaved inappropriately. And there's been a lot of repercussions. Two authors in particular are our focus. One is Jay Asher. He's the author of 13 Reasons Why, a young adult novel about suicide that became a big hit series for Netflix, I believe. Well, he was dropped by his agent, and he's been kicked out of the Society for Children's Book Writers and Illustrators because of the sexual misconduct charges that have come up. The other person is James Dashner of the Maze Runner series. He was dropped by his literary agent and by his publisher, Penguin Random House, and he has apologized. He says, quote, I've taken these past few days for introspection to see if I've been part of the problem. I think that I have. I didn't fully understand boundaries and power dynamics, end quote. So, you know, there's a lot of work to do in a lot of industries, and it just keeps on going in our pop culture realm.
Did they even say, like, whether somebody came out and said something?
As I said, in this article, in the comment section, a lot of women came forward and said, this happened, that happened. Another woman said, that happened to me. So suddenly people started reporting on what was in the comment section. The places initiated investigations. The authors spoke up and said, I didn't go into the details of what they were, you know, accused of or what people said happened and what they responded to, whether, you know, this and that. But they've been fired by their agents. One was dropped by his publisher. It's having serious repercussions, and it's just getting going. It's a big deal. It's, you know, there's a lot of work to do in all these areas, not just in Hollywood.
Oh, I see what you did there. It must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, actually. Our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. And joining us this week, a blast from the past, Karen Woodward. Yes, indeed. You're a social media consultant for the entertainment industry, correct, Karen?
That is correct. Hi, guys.
Well, hey, welcome back. Nice to hear from you.
I know.
Good to be back. Our 400th episode. Our little kid's growing up.
Aww.
I'll tell you, if you ever told me that we would make it to episode 400, I would not have believed it.
How many years has it been?
It's like eight.
I think we started 2000, April 2009. So it's been quite a while, actually. Although your picture is still up there as one of the hosts of the show. We call that laziness.
I call it clickbait.
I don't.
The irony is you're still the only one that looks like their picture.
Do I? That's nice to hear, I guess.
9 years later, we've all aged but Karen.
Well, thanks for joining us. We can duke it out over Big Deal, Big Whoop, just like the old days.
Oh, it'll be fun.
I know, you know, actually, that's how this whole segment started, was you and Michael would go at it, and then when you left, it was just Michael kind of deciding whether it was a big deal or a big whoop.
And then we move on to the next topic. I go, da-da-da-da, and then Sperling goes, moving on. That's less of that back and forth you're really looking for.
Yeah.
Oh, it's nice to be missed.
Well, our first story, speaking of first, for the first time since 2002, the most watched network is not CBS. In fact, it's NBC, which had the Super Bowl, Sunday Night Football, and now the Olympics, to put it back on top among all viewers. CBS has held reign for all but one of the past 15 years, and it took the phenomenon of American Idol, the Super Bowl, and a writer's strike to give Fox the crown in 2008, 10 years ago. NBC will surely dominate for the entire season in key demos, but CBS might just yank back the crown by the end of the ratings period in May. Quick, can Dick Wolf set another show in Chicago? Or at least can we bring back Milo Ventimiglia? I can never pronounce that guy's name, but the guy from, This Is Us. Can we bring him back from the dead for sweeps? Big Deal or Big Whoop? Karen?
I'm going to say this is a big whoop for a couple of reasons. First, does anybody really care what the ratings are for a network anymore? And two, even if we did, how real and valid do we think that is?
Because it's just based on one-time events.
Exactly. And also, like, Dick Wolf did set another show in Chicago that would have been Chicago Justice, and it didn't work. So he's not foolproof.
He's only mostly foolproof. I think it's a big deal. Hey, we're disagreeing.
Yay!
because NBC has taken the lead in the last couple years in the key demo, and they're gaining ground more and more in overall viewers. So this isn't just because of those one-time boosts, though obviously they're helping. So it's a significant change. And I think those total viewers matter for two reasons. One, they actually got advertisers to buy Olympic ads based on their new metric of total audience delivery, TAD, rather than Nielsen's, where they're including network, plus their cable channel streaming, plus their online streaming, to combine all three together to say, hey, this is how many people are watching the Olympics on these three different ways. Everybody wants this. It's really hard to get that metric, but they're all working harder for that. And when you do that and you count up all the viewers, you can see the networks still really are big guns. You know, sure, Netflix has great stuff and HBO has big stuff, but the networks have a lot of big shows that draw a lot of viewers. So, you know, compare them to the History Channel and Lifetime and all that. They're, you know, 800-pound gorillas.
Well, okay. So I do agree with you that their new way of measuring audiences for the Olympics is a big deal. Because it's nice that they're finally acknowledging that. I'm not sure if we're talking impressions or actual reach. So people could be watching it, you know, on their TV, and they could be going back for clips on their phones. I'm not really sure if we know what the difference is there. So that I will agree is a big deal. But I don't think that you can compare NBC to the History Channel and Lifetime. I mean, that is, to me, a very kind of 1990s way of looking at things. You have to compare NBC now to Netflix and Hulu. And what the next generation and the generation after that, how they're going to be watching TV. And it's probably not going to be the networks.
I just think the only thing to compare is the total audience watching the show. I don't care whether it's a streaming site or a cable channel or a network. What matters is how many people watch it. And the better measurement we have, we all agree, the better it is.
And actually, they are combining all of the streaming stuff in. They are, but
it's very hard to determine whether you're counting one person twice. That's why Nielsen hasn't rushed in, because it's so hard to figure out, well, what counts as a total watch of the show? At one point, when they're streaming, do you count it or not? You know, it's tricky.
You mean if I just skim right to the Hanyu performance, the Hanyu?
Right, then you're just there for 5 minutes. So yeah, it's different.
Now, if you're creating theater and want to attract tourists who don't speak the local language, you have one of two choices. On Broadway, musicals like Cats and Phantom of the Opera proved such spectacles that audiences could enjoy them without understanding a word. In the case of Starlight Express, not speaking English might have even helped. This trend accelerated off-Broadway, where shows like Stomp and Blue Man Group dispensed with language entirely. However, there is one more option, and opera embraced it decades ago: subtitles, or in the case of opera, supertitles. Now France is getting into the act. Reports say that a new subtitling service expanded to 13 productions over hundreds of performances in Paris, catering to the tourist crowd. The subtitles can appear on LED screens, on seatbacks, on smartphones, in virtual glasses, and so on. Subtitled shows included everything from classics like Cyrano de Bergerac and El Cid to I Love Edith Piaf and Around the World in 80 Days. Big deal or big whoop? Michael.
Who? Yeah. I think it's a big deal. I stumbled on this story about Parisian theater and thought Broadway should be doing that. Every city should be doing that around the world. It just makes sense. Hell, if you're going to see Hamilton, you might want those Spanish translations, because that's a lot of words.
I agree. It's a big deal for that very reason. I would be concerned that it's a little bit, it's too little too late. Not sure how many people even go to the theater anymore, but it's definitely a nice attempt to get them in there.
You know, what's interesting is it's not easy to do subtitles or supertitles for plays, because, of course, an opera is timed. You know, it's timed to the music so that you know when the next, you know, title should appear. With plays, of course, there is no timing. It's all up to the acting. So that would be interesting.
Well, and also, like, so where are these? I mean, they're on your mobile devices. I get that. So does that mean that we're going to have a bunch of people who are staring at their mobile devices and the glow that comes with it? Is that how that works?
Well, you would have to do it like they do it in the opera, at least at the Metropolitan Opera, where they have them embedded in the seat back and you can see them. But if the person next to you really can't even see your supertitles, so if they don't need them, they won't see yours. It's very non-distracting. You don't want people with their cell phones out, obviously. So I think for Broadway theater, you'd want them embedded in the seats. So it's a big expense to start, but I think it's a smart way to lure tourists.
Well, and that's been an issue in movie theaters, because, of course, when it came to accessibility, one of the first things everybody said was, oh, we'll put them, on mobile phones, because people can bring their own mobile phones and they'll have their own devices. And Hollywood said, you know, we try and get people to put their phones away when they go to the movie theater,
exactly,
not take them out. So, hey, if you post an image on Instagram, does that mean anyone can take the image? What about a tweet? A judge has ruled that news outlets may well have violated copyright by taking an image of Tom Brady from Twitter and using it in the news story, in their own news stories. This is an early ruling that refused to dismiss the case outright. However, that does mean the judge believes there are substantial questions and the plaintiff might well prevail. Mind you, the judge also says there is much to be said on the other side. So what happened? A guy went on Snapchat. So there was a Snapchat user who posted a picture he took of football quarterback Tom Brady and the Boston Celtics general manager. The photo went viral, and then other people posted that photo on Twitter. Then news outlets like Time and the Boston Globe and Vox posted images of the tweets, which included that photo. And they did this in stories about Brady. Now, a judge says those news outlets may have violated copyright. The fact that Twitter was a third-party site hosting the tweets doesn't absolve others, the people who are posting, of getting permission from the original copyright holder, the original Snapchat user. This would have massive implications, so the case is going to be around for a while. Big deal or big whoop, Karen?
This is a very big deal. But at the same time, it's a no-brainer. I mean, everybody who screenshot that guy's Snapchat and used it on their Twitter, every single one of them violated copyright. So then you have, you know, the news sites that are then embedding the tweets from these people who stole it. I think it'd be interesting to know whether they knew that these people who had tweeted it stole it. I think you could probably figure out that they had, because so many people had the same photo and it was different tweets. So yes, they absolutely violated copyright. I'm concerned from the way that I read this article that people seem to think, oh no, now we can no longer embed tweets. That's absolutely not what this ruling says. You can embed tweets. You just can't steal someone's photo from something. So it shouldn't be about the news sites. It's about the people on Twitter who stole this guy's photograph, which is clear copyright.
So does that mean if you said it's just news that they posted it on a public feed so you can repeat it and you're not liable, but the original tweeter is? You know, like you're the third person to steal the image, sort of. You're just showing that they stole the image, even though that's not what you're writing a story about. So like you're okay, because he's saying you're not okay just because you didn't do it originally.
Well, I think it becomes an interesting question whether the news outlets knew that this was stolen. I would argue that you could easily see that it was stolen because so many people on Twitter were using the exact same image, which would give me pause for sure. But if the argument, and it sounds like the argument that the news sites are making, is that, oh, we're never going to be allowed to embed anything on Twitter anymore. Well, I don't think that's true at all. But if it does force them to really think about what it is that they're embedding and where that came from, that's only a good thing. Because otherwise, let's be honest, fake news.
So you can embed Justin Timberlake's tweet, but, you know, make sure he didn't include some stuff he stole in it.
Well, exactly.
And speaking of Justin Timberlake, a backlash against entertainer Justin Timberlake just reared its head. He didn't make amends to Janet Jackson, said some. He's too white and he's appropriating black culture, say others, painting Timberlake as this millennium's Pat Boone. He's boring, say others, who snoozed during the Super Bowl halftime show and missed, well, nothing. He's incredibly talented, yet somehow bland, like Jimmy Fallon, and that won't cut it in the age of Trump, says Sperling Reich. Hey, wait, that's me. In any case, Timberlake keeps moving forward. His new album debuted at number one. He's got four songs on the Hot 100, including a recent top 10 hit, with a duet featuring Chris Stapleton. He's got a massive world tour on sale now, in which 700,000 tickets sold for a total of $100 million in grosses. And counting. So that backlash, it's going to have to wait until Timberlake is, you know, until he has time to pay attention to it, somewhere around 2019. Big deal or big whoop, Karen?
I went first last time. In fact, Michael didn't even answer the big whoop, big deal, big whoop for the Snapchat tweet Tom Brady.
Well, I agreed with you that it's a big deal because it's interesting. And I think your analysis was right, spot on.
Well, what about
Mr.
Timberlake?
And this time I will say this is a big whoop. There's a backlash against popular people all the time, and I'm not a huge Timberlake fan. I kind of like him somehow, but I just wish his actual albums were better. But so what? Yeah, people get sick of him because he's so popular. I understand. I didn't think his Super Bowl show was great, but whatever, he'll survive.
I mean, when the selfie kid is more charismatic than you, you've got a problem, man. Yeah, this is big whoop, right? Big whoop. I mean, come on. Who cares?
My kids are just obsessed that the guy who had the selfie taken with him got on the Ellen DeGeneres show. They love Ellen, and they're like, you know, why couldn't we have the selfie taken? I'm like, you know, actually, it's not. You could meet Ellen DeGeneres in other ways. You don't need to have a selfie taken with Justin Timberlake to have that done.
Or you too, sweetheart, can have an iPhone 6 that barely runs.
Exactly. Now, Netflix isn't done shaking up the TV and movie industry. Now they've snagged Ryan Murphy away from Fox. Did I say Fox? I mean Fox and Disney. The latter CEO, Bob Iger, personally wooed Murphy to come to the Mouse House. Instead, the very successful TV series creator has signed a $250 million deal, and probably more than that, to deliver TV shows and movies exclusively to Netflix. Of course, American Crime Story and American Horror Story will stay right where they are, but if you want to see Murphy's next attention-getting series, you're gonna need Netflix. It's not a complete shock. Murphy already had two shows for Netflix. The One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest prequel, which we've talked about, it's called Ratched, like Nurse Ratched. And The Politician, a political musical satire. Is that even a thing? Big deal or big whoop, Karen?
I think this is a big deal. It kind of goes back to what I was saying about whether CBS versus NBC is relevant. I mean, the good content is going to be on these paying streaming services. And so for that reason alone, it's a big deal. It's kind of a big middle finger, I think, to broadcast nets. Michael?
Well, that's why I think it's a big whoop, for your very reason, because whether someone switches from CBS to ABC or ABC to HBO or HBO to Netflix, it doesn't matter. So Netflix stole a guy away.
But it does, because the choice that he made, he went from broadcast to streaming. That's a big deal.
I don't think it is anymore. I think we've gone past the point where we're like, oh my God, Netflix is a competitor. Yeah, they're spending billions of dollars a year on content. Of course they're a competitor. They could make Black Panther if they wanted. They got a lot of money. So I feel like, yeah, they've already arrived. They got Shonda Rhimes. They got Ryan Murphy. They are not messing around. They are taking the biggest names from each network. And I wanted to say, oh, Shonda Rhimes just did How to Get Away with Murder. That's sort of weak. I wanted to look at a recent Ryan Murphy show and say, are they buying these people just past their peak when they've done their best work? It's possible. But you know what? Looking at his stuff, it's all commercially successful anyway, like Feud, which I didn't like. But hey, it made money. It got Emmy nominations. So I can't paint the picture that he's already past his prime. So, you know, they may be paying him at his peak, but he's still, I'm sure, got a couple big shows in him.
He probably has a lot, because a lot of the stuff that he wants to do artistically probably wouldn't fly on a broadcast network.
And that's true, actually.
Yeah, that was his problem at FX, right? With Nip Tuck, he was always pushing the envelope.
Especially given what that show was about.
Plastic surgery?
Well, you know, of particular body parts that he couldn't show. Pinewood Studios has decided to focus on, well, its studios, actually. The company has shuttered attempts to expand into films and financing and stick to what it knows best. Pinewood has been the home of the James Bond films, and in 2001, it bought out arch-rival Shepperton Studios, making it the 800-pound gorilla when it comes to studio space in the United Kingdom. Now they've snapped up 100 more acres to enable expansion for years to come. Now, just for a comparison, Shepperton currently takes up 25 acres of space. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. Studio buys land.
I totally agree. Big whoop. Real estate deal.
It would be a big deal if it was the 100 acres wood that they purchased. That would be shocking and upsetting to all Winnie the Pooh fans. But other than that, it's a big whoop.
Universal Music Group had a record-breaking 2017. Their revenue included recorded music, publishing, and so on. It leaped 10% over 2016. You won't be surprised to learn the biggest area of growth. That was streaming, which jumped 34% despite Universal striking a new licensing deal with Spotify that mostly lowered the rate on which its payments are determined. Some people do actually buy music, like me, but their numbers are falling. Physical formats like LPs and compact discs and digital downloads, both, they all dropped, basically. Big deal or big whoop, Karen?
What?
Universal hit a record.
This was like such
billion.
A boring story. I was having a hard time following. So they struck a new licensing deal with Spotify?
No, that Universal Music Group, actually, they made, all their revenue rose 10% over 2016. And as we all know, the music industry has been suffering, and Universal Music Group being one of the big three, having revenue rise 10% it's saying something.
Okay, I suspect this is a big deal, but since I personally don't know that much or care that much about the music industry and their revenues, I'm going to say big whoop.
Well, I've got sunshine in my pocket over this story, so I'm going to say it's a big deal. Streaming is starting to contribute real dollars, real pennies. It's not trickling down to the artists and the songwriters, but at least it's moving in the right direction. You know, we've got a lot of people paying for streaming media, and it's starting to pay off.
Well, we always said once you hit 50 million subscribers, then it was going to start to pay off. It probably was more like 100 million subscribers, and it's definitely paying off. Now, what the artists are saying is, wow, that's amazing. It's really paying off for you, you labels. It's great. Are we ever going to see any of it? Ever?
The answer is no. Keep touring. Sell merchandise. Then you'll make money.
Yeah, that's what the labels say. They turn to their artists and go, don't you know? I mean, recorded music is dead. The money's in touring. Go tour. Anyway,
4 billion views on your video is nothing.
Yes, that's true. Now, YouTube TV Skinny Bundle just got a little fatter. The service raised its price $5 to a total of $40 in all, but it also got fatter in the number of channels on tap. They've got more live sports thanks to the addition of NBA TV and MLB TV channels, both of which offer the sporting events that cord cutters don't actually want to cut out of their lives. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I'm going to say it's a big deal in the negative sense. They're raising their price. They added some sports, which is what people want when they cut their cord. They want those sporting channels. They miss them and their major networks and PBS. But, you know, now we're up to $40, right? Soon it's going to be $45. Then you have to pay $40 or $45 for decent Wi-Fi. Guess what? You're back to $90, $100. Doesn't take much to get right back to where you wanted to be before on cable. It's just you've got 400 less channels.
Right? I mean, I had the exact same thought. On some level, it's always interesting to see how, you know, the different ways that people are watching TV. But the price now is just, are you kidding me? Like, you might as well have a cable subscription. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, $40 is, I mean, $35 was kind of like, okay, yeah, all right, fine.
No, not even then. Nothing
really?
More than $20.
Nothing more than $20? Wow, okay. So $10 more than
so
streaming.
So like two Netflixes.
Well, yeah, but to your point, you still have to have, you know, high-speed internet.
And speaking of high-speed, YouTube has YouTube Red, which they are now clarifying yet again. It will be basically a music service, and they're going to be available in more than 100 countries. So the good thing about this is at least Skinny Bundles provide competition. And for the minority of people who just want 30 or 40 channels and don't mind reducing their internet a little bit, at least there's an option. And now there'll be more competition for Spotify and Apple Music, and that's a good thing.
It seems like TV and streaming rights for live sporting events have been going up and up and up. Well, maybe they're starting to come back down, or at least stop getting more expensive. We know American football is ever so slightly cooling in the ratings after the NFL allowed TV to broadcast games 8 days a week. It's still expensive, and it's on too many nights, and it still costs a ton, but reality may be sinking back into that league. That's also the case in the UK, where European football, also known as football, is the biggest game in town, and Premier League is the hottest division around. Rumors were swirling that Amazon and others were planning to make a big bid, but it turns out that Sky and BT, British Telecom, have retained the rights to the games they've been carrying of the Premier League, and guess what? The price went down a little. They paid $6.3 billion for the games, and everyone heaved a huge sigh of relief. Michael?
I think it's a big deal, actually, because it's turning a corner. You know, they kept the rights and they paid less. You know, a little sanity is coming back into live sporting events. It's so overpriced, I think, that it has to come back down to earth. And I'm glad to see it's finally doing that.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with you, but I'm going to toss in another idea here. Where's Facebook in all of this? Why are they not doing, and I know in some cases they actually are, doing this as Facebook Lives. And just selling, you know, people's eyeballs to advertisers.
Well, they are. And in fact, that is why, you know, Sheryl Sandberg and Jack Dorsey, Sheryl Sandberg being from Facebook, Jack Dorsey being the head of Twitter, they had to resign from Disney's board of directors because, you know, Bob Iger and the board turned to them and said, you're kind of becoming a competitor since you're now streaming video.
They had to recuse themselves from vote after vote because they and ESPN were competing more and more to try and bid for stuff. So they're like, you know, when you have to recuse yourself from 40% of the vote, maybe you should step away. So, yeah, I mean, Twitter is streaming baseball games. Facebook has gotten action on some live sporting events. On the Super Bowl, we saw YouTube boasting about the soccer that they were going to be airing. So it's happening.
And that, to me, is a big deal.
Yeah. More competitors, and that should drive the price up. And yet the price went down a little bit, even with the idea that Amazon and others were going to start bidding like Apple. So I think they were just way overpriced. Even with more competition, the price still came down. That shows you how inflated sporting event prices were.
A minute ago, the Weinstein Company announced David Glasser would be running the company for its new owners when a sale went through. Then the New York State Attorney General said, and let me get the legal wording correct here because I think it's pronounced specifically, nope. Now the Weinstein Company has fired Glasser as unfit in a desperate attempt to keep the sale on track. If the investor group led by Maria Contreras Sweet holds firm, they'll have a $500 million price tag, which includes, by the way, $275 million in the purchase price plus $225 million in debt that they'd be taking on. If they back off, the chances of someone else coming forward dims and the end of the Weinstein Company would seem to be almost inevitable. Big deal or big whoop. Karen.
Well, I guess the question is, which part is the big deal, big whoop? His having to go in order to sell this company?
Well, yeah, I guess that would be that. That is the news story here, is that they basically said initially they fought to keep David Glasser, you know, a year and a half ago, and they paid him more money, the Weinstein brothers. And then, he stuck around after he said he was leaving. And then when, everything happened last fall with Harvey Weinstein, yeah, they said, no, he's going to be here. There's some, continuity. And basically the Attorney General of New York said, he's part of the problem. He's got to go too. And, rather than fight for him, they went, okay, throw him under the bus.
So I think this would have been a really big deal a few months ago. At this point, I am happy to say that it is, I guess, sort of less of a big deal. I'm happy to see the stink removed from this company. And without knowing this man or really the story behind him, who knew? Maybe he was the one good guy who works there, in which case continuity would be a good thing. But if not, if he was complicit, just like, arguably all or at least most of the other executives there, then get rid of them. I mean, there are so many executives that are in search of jobs right now. And there's got to be a few really good ones, and let's bring them back.
Are there any jobs left? That's my question. I mean, it just seems like they're really, development is out the window. Nobody develops anything unless it's a piece of intellectual property that revolves around a cape or tights.
Well, that's true. But that's actually kind of my point, is that you have so many development executives that are, available and are really good. Why can't the Weinstein Company remake itself as what Miramax originally was, which was, a studio that really cared about making good movies?
Well, it's funny that you should say that, because Amazon, of course, that's what Amazon was becoming, right? I mean, they had Manchester by the Sea, and this year, The Big Sick. They were becoming that kind of the little indie label that could. And what Jeff Bezos and Amazon Studios have said is, actually, we need big blockbusters. So that's what we're going to go after, is big blockbusters. And maybe we're not going to acquire films at film festivals as much or at all anymore. And instead, we're going to, try and hit home runs rather than solid singles and solid doubles.
But when you're in the movie theater business, you have to hit home runs because it's so expensive. If they want to make these quiet little movies, then they're going to have to stick with the, people staying in their homes in the on-demand crowd, which I don't think is a bad thing.
Well, and I would say the movie theater crowd, there is a market for, The Greatest Showman. There's a market for The Big
Darkest
Sick.
Hour.
Yeah, The Darkest Hour.
Billboards. Yeah, Lady Bird. They all made money.
Yeah. What do you think?
But I think this is a big whoop because they didn't need him in the first place. I think the Weinstein name is so damaged, I don't think the company can survive. They're just going to have to rename it. So I'm not sure what they're saving. I feel bad for the lower level people who did no wrong and are losing their jobs. But it just feels like this is all going to collapse and they're just going to have to sell off the pieces.
Yeah, no, I agree. At this point, who cares about the executives unless there's somebody really, truly, geniusly amazing? I mean, I would be more interested in just to know what scripts they're developing over there.
They actually develop scripts still? That's interesting. I didn't know that still happened.
Well, you know what I'm saying.
They had the book publishing company. They optioned authors. They were good developers for a while.
Yeah, I know.
And then whatever their evil personal life.
Well, speaking of personal lives, that was actually, I just realized now, our last big deal or big whoop story for this week. So.
No.
Hello, was Sperling.
I torture Michael when you're not around, Karen.
Aww.
Usually with lots of numbers. I just throw lots of numbers at him.
40% over the third quarter of the last year.
Yeah, that's so boring, you guys. Come on.
Usually, Michael will stop me half, you know, midway through a sentence if there's more than three numbers mentioned. So, and forget about it. If the word percent is in any sentence, he's usually just, that's like an automatic cutoff. That's, I can't continue the sentence.
I'm going to have to side with Michael on this one.
Well, thanks for joining us, and we'll bring you back on show 500.
Oh, please do.
Or come back to 401, baby.
Where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter at Karen_Woodward.
Okay.
Or on my website, KarenWoodwardOnline.com.
Okay. And of course, you're always available for social media consulting to the entertainment industry.
That is correct.
Well, thank you very much for coming back to join us on, I guess, what is a milestone episode for us.
Oh, thank you guys. This was fun.
Cool. Thanks a lot. Oh, that was fun to have Karen back there battling back and forth with her about whether something's a big deal or a big whoop. It's been a long time.
Yeah, and I kind of forgot the dynamic you two have and why that segment worked.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
But that moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, I mean, we've been discussing for several years how Barnes & Noble looks to be in bad shape, but it can take a while for the largest physical bookstore chain in North America to collapse. Okay, this is a North American story. I guess in the UK and elsewhere, there are other big giant bookstores. Now, like the Titanic, Barnes & Noble hit an iceberg known as Amazon, and it has been taking on water for quite a while. Well, now it seems the ship has lurched upwards, the bow of the boat pointed to the sky. Jack and Rose are clinging to each other, desperately trying to figure out what to do, and the whole damn thing is about to sink into the sea. Hold on, has Jack cried out. So, Michael, where are we at?
Okay, so in December, which is typically a bookstore's best month, sales at Barnes & Noble fell 6%. Ooh. Online sales also fell. That was a bummer. A year earlier, they'd had sort of a brief bit of good news. In 2016, sales actually rose for the first time since the Great Recession. Well, didn't matter. In 2017, especially after that December, sales fell again for the entire year, some 3.7%. Hoping the holidays might turn things around, prove fruitless. Now the news gets really bad. I think we reported it last week. Did it happen before or after Barnes & Noble announced that they'd made some layoffs and would expect to save around $40 million a year? You're like, oh, okay, wow, I wonder what happened. Well, here's what they actually did. They fired 1,800 people. And in fact, according to employees who have reached out to journalists or posted online, it seems like they fired virtually every single full-time employee at every one of their 781 stores in North America. According to those former employees, they fired most everyone in the following roles: the head cashiers, the receiving managers, the digital leads, those are the folks in charge of the nooks, the newsstand leads, and the bargain leads. Those are the big areas of the bookstore. I guess the coffee leads got to stay in place.
Well, again, the coffee, you know, the cafe is a completely separate...
Is it run by different people?
I don't know about that. That's actually, you know, Starbucks is responsible for all the products.
It's branded for it, but I didn't know whether they were completely separate or what. That's
a good question.
And not that it matters, because, you know, it's just saying they fired all the people in the bookstore area. Well, apparently a handful of the largest locations in the country were able to keep their head cashier and receiving manager, but not many. And in fact, I went to Barnes & Noble the other day and did not recognize most of the people. I was like, oh, there were new people at the cash register, new people at the information desk, people I hadn't seen regularly. It's like, oh, wow. And they also fired a lot of shipping receivers in December, further strangling their supply chain. For the moment, stores are being staffed by the part-timers who were already there and temps. Welcome to the gig economy.
Yeah, so you know, what's interesting to me is that I went to Barnes & Noble over the weekend. Looking for a magazine, Monocle magazine. My subscription lapsed and I was going to miss the February issue, so I went to look for it. And I had been into the store a couple of times last week looking for it, thinking, well, it's got to be put on the shelf at any time now. Any moment it'll show up. No. And so finally, Saturday night, I said, okay, I'm going to ask if they even carry it anymore. And Barnes & Noble here in a suburban town to have a magazine like Monocle or Wallpaper or frankly, a lot of these.
They totally have it, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable that they do. So I asked, and it took me a while for the one cash register person, to find somebody that could come and help me. And then they couldn't find it either. They said, look, we don't have it. We don't know where it went. We don't know where it is. We normally carry it. And then I said, okay, well, I'll buy Surface magazine, you know, a nice little art magazine. Mm-hmm. And I stood in line for like 15 minutes trying to pay for one magazine.
And, you know, when you get rid of your full-time staffers and all their knowledge and their customer service experience, and, you know, a grocery store is not the same as a bookstore, which is not the same as a coffee store. You know, you got to know books. You are throwing in the towel. It's just a last-ditch effort to stay alive a few more quarters. I mean, it's really not good.
Well, and then I took my daughter to a soccer tournament way out in the Inland Empire this week. And on the way back, we stopped in Pasadena, and across the street from where we were having lunch was Vroman's Bookstore. Very well-known West Coast chain, been around since, I think, 1897, you know, it was over 100 years old. And we spent, you know, half an hour to 45 minutes in this huge bookstore. I mean, it's not as big as the Strand, but it has everything from fountain pens to stationery to, you know, fountain pen ink to pottery.
What about books?
No, it has tons of books. Okay, I mean, tons
of
books.
Does it use books?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know, but it has a whole area. While we were there, there was a whole area for somebody just to do a reading. And I don't mean just like a little tiny corner. I mean, like there were rows and rows and rows of chairs, you know, and this person was giving a reading and a talk on their, you know, an author giving a talk on a book that was crowded. And I thought, wow, this bookstore has it dialed in.
Well, you know, and that's the thing. The indie bookstores that were really successful did that. They had a cafe, they had tours, they had reading things, they had book times where they read to kids. And Barnes & Noble said, hey, that's great. And they adapted that. They had a great selection. They offered all those things and more. And they had a great era. And now that era is gone. So Barnes & Noble, they're going to be gone sooner rather than later. It's going to be a disaster for the publishing industry. The one positive, perhaps, is that indie stores like that can benefit. But that's a fool's bargain in terms of the publishing world, because that's really, you know, they're going to benefit, but not enough to make up for everything that you're losing from Barnes & Noble. So that's going to be a real bummer.
It's also going to be a real problem for retail outlets and retail centers in the United States, because that's where these big Barnes & Noble, I don't want to say superstores, but some of these Barnes & Noble stores are big. And they're
anchor stores. Yeah.
Right. And so that's going to be a huge problem. Because already Borders is gone, right? So that happened a couple years, you know, 5 years ago. And now you've got, if Barnes & Noble goes away, and Macy's is going away, you're just shedding these anchor tenants. And it's going to be just, it's just going to be it's going to crater that kind of commercial real estate.
We're looking at a third of all retail malls going under, you know, in the next 10 years. I mean, they're talking about that. When you're losing all these anchor stores, why are you going to go to the mall? You know, if there's no Macy's, no Barnes & Noble, it gets harder and harder. When you have empty stores, the rest of the mall suddenly seems desolate. It's not fun to go there anymore. And it just builds and builds. Then you're going to have a lot of extra real estate available. That's going to depress prices on the others that are still around. It's just a vicious circle. But back to publishing, it's going to hurt author tours, which is less and less of a thing, but it still happens. There's going to be no showcasing of books. Even if you don't go into a Barnes & Noble, frankly, you walk by, you drive by, you're reminded, oh yeah, books.
Speaking of showcasing, when I walked past the Barnes & Noble to get into it, I did notice the window. You know what I noticed? Yeah. Nothing was in it at all.
It was empty?
Completely empty.
Wow. And
I thought,
oh my God.
Normally they have, you know, like some kind of book of the month or, you know, like a theme, like, oh, it's back to school or, you know, oh, it's Halloween. Here are all the Halloween books. Nothing.
Well, and the other problem is the Nook. The Nook was a great device. It's not compatible with the Amazon books that you buy. That's been a problem from the start. You should be able to buy your album from anyone and play it on any music device. You should be able to buy a book from Barnes & Noble or Amazon or anywhere and play it on any device you have. That's a big problem because all those people who bought Nooks and have been loyal all these years, they're going to be screwed. And then there's the publishers. Even the top publishers are going to have to rethink their cash flow. They often get a chunk of cash from Barnes & Noble for the physical books. A book comes out on Tuesday, like In the Enemy's House. They say, give us 10,000 copies or whatever, or 2,000 copies, and they pay for them and give you cash. That cash is used by the publishers, especially the indie publishers, to promote the book that you've just taken and then help sell it. And now that's how they've been doing business for years. They expect that sort of upfront cash from Barnes & Noble. That's sort of like, okay, we'll use that and we'll do marketing. Well, guess what? That money's not coming anymore. Amazon's like, we'll take 2.7 books and you better have them ready. So the whole ecosystem is really going to suffer. This is going to be a bad, bad thing for a long time to come. It doesn't get much bigger than this. Well, and guess what? Bookstore sales in North America overall, as far as I can tell, they dropped in 2017. I don't know what happened at Amazon, but the physical chains, it dropped again. So people are talking about the comeback of the indies. They're going to do well in the next few years because Barnes & Noble is going to disappear, but it's not nearly going to make up for the shortfall of what we've lost.
Well, and one of the issues that you'll really face with the publishing industry undergoing such changes is that what is published here in the United States then goes overseas, whether it's translated or just winds up in the UK or Australia. Likewise, you know, what is being published in the UK and in Europe and elsewhere winds up here in the United States, usually sold through Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And so if you don't have those places to sell through or you're changing the way that the industry works, you may not even have the works to import or export.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're going to have fewer books for sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's an issue in and of itself. So that's really how it's going to affect our listeners. Now, just to point out, by the way, you mentioned that the people who own Nooks might be kind of left out in the cold. The Nook supports the EPUB format, which is also the same thing that is supported on iBooks. However, if you bought a book through Barnes & Noble, an e-book through Barnes & Noble, it is tied to your Nook and your device. And there's, you know, digital copyright management on that. So that's the problem.
But you can't buy a book on Amazon and put it on your Nook, can you?
I don't believe so. You'd have to go through some kind
right.
of,
Right. I can't buy a book on Barnes & Noble and put it on my Kindle. So that's an inherent problem that's been going on a long time. And of course, the lie that you're just licensing the book and you can't transport it to another device is also part of the problem. Like, well, you just licensed it for your Nook. You know, just because if you buy a Kindle tomorrow, you can't go, all right, I want all the 500 books I bought to appear on my Kindle like you would with your albums. That doesn't happen.
No, but you know what does happen? Every week.
The end of our show?
Yes. And every week, like clockwork, we say, great, this week we're going to be under an hour. And every week, like clockwork, we're not.
Not the 400th episode. I never thought is this where I get to sing You Never Walk Alone like Jerry Lewis?
Yes, that's right. Oh, yes. If you listened to last week's show, you'd understand this reference.
Or ever watch the Labor Day telethon.
Correct. Now, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, or Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher. Anywhere they give podcasts away for free is usually where you can find our show. And we do appreciate it when you rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. So again, you can find that information on how to subscribe to us on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That is also where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. It's also where you'll find ways to follow us at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle on Twitter. You can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. You can reach out via email, dirt@showbizsandbox is our email address. Or you can call us, leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. I'd like to thank Karen Woodward for joining us today. I'd also like to thank MGMT for providing our theme music. Music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by that indie rock group, MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it is something new and exciting. Our website is showbizsandbox.com. Michael's website is...
It's our 400th episode. Rate and review us for Pete's sake, .com.
Well, you know, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to his personal website, MichaelGiltz.com, to, you know, find out what he's been up to. You can also check out BookFilter.com to know what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.